decisions, I'm sure. And then, of course, there's the R number that's been talked about, particularly in our region over the last few days or so, which is the average number of secondary infections produced by one infected person. Yeah, it takes a little while to get your head around this. Well, to talk us through what that actually means and to talk about what could be a significant new drug trial in the battle with COVID is Dr. Tom Fletcher, a consultant in the Tropical Infectious Diseases Unit at the Royal Liverpool, works at Broad Green University Hospitals as well. Tom, thanks for your expertise this morning. Thanks for coming on. Good to have you with us.
All right, good morning.
Let's just start, we'll talk about the R number in a second, but let's just start with this new drug trial that you're leading on. It's called Agile. What is it and what are you hoping it will do?
Right. Well, there's been a number of trials of drugs for COVID-19 since the beginning of the outbreak, including big trials in the UK, one of which recently suggested there was no benefit for hydroxychloroquine, which, as you've probably seen, has been in the news a lot, particularly from the US. But a number of these trials are only really treating people in hospital when they've already got pretty sick with this infection. Mm. So what we're trying to do with this new trial called Agile is look at much more exciting new drug compounds and try to treat patients much more at an earlier stage in the community. And so that's the aim of Agile, really, to try and treat people with brand new antivirals and try to stop them getting sick and going to hospital.
So this is a treatment rather than a vaccine, which of course is different, but it sounds equally as important, this.
It is indeed, you're right. There's been a lot of focus on developing vaccines, and we know they take quite a long time to develop for infections such as this. However, we do still desperately need better antiviral treatments. And so this trial, Agile, will start to rapidly look at these new compounds. And the first one we're evaluating in Liverpool is probably the most exciting compound for this pandemic.
So from the start to where we are now with Agile, how long has that taken? I mean, you must have done this at a lightning pace.
It has. I mean, everything has moved very quickly in this outbreak. A normal sort of research timelines have gone out the window, really. And that's really an understanding of we don't have time to go through the normal stages of developing drugs and putting them in clinical trials. So we need to move quickly. And that's why we hope to start in the next couple of weeks.
Mm. So presumably you'll need to see people who are at the early stages of actually having the virus. So Agile will manage and treat while the busy work of finding the vaccine is going on in the background. Have I got that right?
Yeah, exactly. So we know that what we want to use is antiviral drugs to target the virus at a very early stage of illness. So for the first drug, we're really looking at people in the first 5 days of illness and those who are more at risk of getting severe disease. So those who are a bit older and those who have other medical problems like high blood pressure or diabetes. That's the group in a couple of weeks that we want to recruit into Agile and to give them this drug.
Is there a temptation sometimes to get slightly carried away, Tom? You know, when you've made a discovery, I mean, tell me if I'm using the wrong terminology, but if you've made a discovery and you think, this is something here, this is Agile, we think this can work. Do you have to stop yourself sometimes from snowballing and running away? Because we've been disappointed in the past, haven't we?
Of course, and I think you have to recognise that with any drug trial or any new treatment, the reason they're put into clinical trials is that they may not work. But in the same way, in the same instance, the only drugs that we put into Agile are those that we think have a real chance of benefit for patients. So they've been through an in-depth sort of scrutiny about how they work and how safe they are. And that's the key feature, that we only put them in if they've got a reasonable chance of success.
Okay, well, let's keep all our hopes on that for now. Can we move on to the R number? And we'll try and make some sense of the R number. Many will know how it works, but for those who are still a little bit fuzzy with it, what does it mean? What is the R number and why should it be low?
Sure. So the R number is something that I think everybody has heard about since the beginning of the outbreak, really. It's a key number that lets you know how you're doing in controlling the outbreak, to put it crudely. So putting it simply, the R number reflects the number of people that one person who has this infection will then pass it on to. So at the height of the outbreak a few months ago in the UK, that was between 3 and 4. So it meant that if you were sick, on average, you'd pass it on to 3 or 4 other people. And we know then that those graphs shoot up rapidly when you have that amount of spread to 3 or 4 people. Now that number has obviously come down, and when we know it's less than one, we know that the outbreak will gradually peter out. But there's obviously a bit of concern in different areas of the UK as that has gone above one again, which would suggest that the outbreak could increase.
Of course, northwest and southwest have been mentioned with the R either being one or slightly over one. What is the difference? Because, I mean, you work in this field, but just as somebody who watches the briefings every day and we see Matt Hancock say, in the northwest, it's one, or we see, you know, our local mayors, you know, being really concerned about this. If it's just under one in the northeast, but it's just over one in the northwest, what difference does that make? I mean, it doesn't sound like it's a huge difference, but what difference does that make?
Well, I think the first thing we should understand is that these numbers are not exact, so they're an estimate or a best guess of where they are in regions based on the data that people have available. And trying to compare, say, the R, if it's 0.97 in one area of the country and 1.03 in another, there's probably not a huge difference between those two figures, especially when the case numbers are relatively low. So if you considered if the R was, say, 1.1 and you only had 10 or 12 cases around, you know, in the next cycle that would then be 12 or 15 cases. Mm. It's a big difference if it's 1,000 cases, then that obviously increases significantly. So while we still have low case numbers and the R is around one, we should still have the ability to identify those patients, test them and isolate them.
It's important, of course. The R number is extremely important. But, you know, as somebody on the outside looking in, do you think that we've become fixated with numbers and graphs? And of course, there will be a lot of people over the weekend who went, oh my goodness me, the R number is just over one where I live. You know, this is a catastrophe. Do you think we become fixated with graphs and the media and the way things are projected to us?
Yeah, I mean, these are unusual times and you can understand why people are so sort of fixated and focused on these individual numbers. But for me, it's more about a trend. So we know that the R number has gone up in a number of areas over the UK. So whilst it may just be around one or just under one, it's certainly higher than it was several weeks ago in the height of lockdown when it was around 0.4 or up to 0.7 in some areas. And so for me, that's probably the more interesting thing to look at, is what is the R doing over time as opposed to the absolute figure of what it is.
And just to finish with, we always try to end our conversations with specialists like yourself and, you know, other colleagues of yours with what we call a crumb of comfort. Should we panic? Should we overly panic in the Northwest because it's slightly, or it's seen to be, said to be slightly just over one at the moment? Should we overly panic about this?
No, I mean, I don't think we should. I think all the public health measures that have been recommended by the government are still in place in terms of social distancing, essential travel, etc. And I think we must still respect those. And I guess there's a fear that when the severe lockdown has sort of ended, people think they can return back to normal. And clearly we can't with this virus still circulating. I mean, in terms of fear, I think the other thing that we should recognise that the hospitals in the Northwest and in Liverpool in particular have done a remarkable job to manage, you know, huge numbers of cases, and are therefore ideally prepared if there is more cases or another wave to come. That will be much easier the second time round because all the procedures are in place to manage cases if we get more in the future.
Tom, we're going to leave it there, but thanks very much indeed for your time this morning. There's Dr. Tom Fletcher, who's a consultant in tropical infectious diseases at the Royal and at Broadgreen University Hospitals. We're so lucky to have people like Tom and so many people we've spoken to over the last few months.
Yeah, who've been able to explain things in a way that we can understand, because it's hard to process. As you say, the R number, it doesn't really mean an awful lot to us, does it? But when they break it down in a way that we can understand and try and not get too worried.
Bogged down with it, yeah, you're right. I meant to ask him then, I just didn't get a chance. So if the R's like under one and I have it, how can I infect somebody if it's under one?
Yeah.
See, that's what I can't
what the repercussions are. Yeah. We'll save that for the next expert.
Save it for the next one, the next expert. Yeah, you're right. Okay. 17.